But you could have chosen any bar. There's plenty a whole lot nicer in Taggart's, and plenty where you're less liable to get your head busted. Maybe I wanted to be where the action is. Or maybe you wanted to be nowhere near home. Alistair looked furtive. Kinda. So's you're less likely to bump into someone who'd recognize you and could rat on you to your mom. She even know you're out? The kid shook his head. She doesn't pay much attention to my comings and goings, on account of how sick she is. I look after her, do my best for her, but I need a life of my own, you understand? I need to get out now and then, have a little fun. Caring for a sick person ain't easy, especially one with Foster's wheeze. Mom's coughing all the time, sometimes like as though she's going to choke up a lung. I never know from one day to the next how bad she's going to be, but I do know she's not likely to get better. Jane sympathized, perhaps more than Alistair realized. His little brother Maddie suffered from an incurable respiratory disorder not unlike Foster's wheeze, damp lung, and it blighted his life and that of their mother, too. Evesdown's Riverside District might once have been pretty, desirable even, but its heyday was long past. The river itself, which had never been graced with a name, was a slow, turgid waterway, clogged with weed, junk, and sewage, and the houses which clustered along its banks were low, mean edifices, with tumble-down roofs and sagging walls. Alistair led Jane up a precarious outdoor staircase to a fourth-floor apartment that was not what you might call spacious. Anyone who got it in mind to swing a cat in there could expect a lot of thumping and irate meowing. On a cot in a corner of the main room lay an emaciated woman whose complexion was the color of cream gone sour. Blood-flecked tissues were scattered around her like gruesome confetti, and dried incrustations scabbed her nostrils and the corners of her mouth. The air smelled of stale sweat, human waste, and, beneath it all, the faint whiff of rotten flesh. The woman managed, with some considerable effort, to raise herself as Alistair and Jane entered. Her hair hung lank about her face like damp seaweed, while her eyes were sunk so deep in their sockets they were almost lost, like pebbles embedded in deep hollows. Jane could tell she had been attractive once, before the sickness had ravaged her. She was still fairly young, although her haggardness made her look about 100 years old.
Alistair, she said in a frail voice. That you?
It's me, Mom.
Your face. Those bruises.
Her brow furrowed.
What happened to you? What have you been doing?
Nothing, Mama. Just had a little mishap, is all. Got jumped by a couple of guys.
Not far from the truth, Jane thought.
They tried to take my money, Alistair continued. Only I didn't have none, so that made him real mad, and, well, you can see the result. I'm fine, he added. Really, just a few lumps and bumps. This man saved me. His name's...
Alistair suddenly looked puzzled.
Not sure I caught it, as a matter of fact, he said.
Cobb, Jane said. Jane Cobb. Pleased to meet you, ma'am.
He removed his hat. Mama Cobb had raised him to be polite when the circumstances demanded. Alistair's mother eyed him up and down.
That was mighty kind of you, Jane Cobb. I am much obliged. My name's Barbara, by the way.
Barbara, then a coughing fit overtook her. Her body heaved, racked with spasms. She covered her mouth, but Jane saw blood and sputum spatter against the palm of her hand. Alistair hurried to her side, handing her a tissue. Then he fetched her a glass of water, which she sipped gratefully.
I thought I should return Alistair home safe and sound, Jane said. He told me you might be able to fix him up, and now that I've done that...
Won't you stay? Barbara said. We've food in the house. Coffee, too. Ain't much, but we're willing to share, especially with someone who's helped us out.
It was tempting. Jane was hungry, and he was never less than a slave to his appetites. However, there was Mal to think about. He couldn't hang around. Thanks, but I got some pressing matters need attending to.
You mean partying with all the other fools?
No. Yes. No.
Jane was not proficient at lying, so he changed the subject.
Fools, you say? I'm guessing you're no fan of Alliance Day, then.
Ha!
Barbara swung her legs over the side of the cot. The strain of moving herself even that much showed on her face.
Well, put it like this. There's some as reckon the war was the best thing that could ever have happened to the verse. And there's some, like me, as think it was the worst. Not to mention the pain and suffering it caused. I used to be a nurse, worked for the military whiles. The independents, only I don't make a big noise about that, owing to the fact that they were the losing side, and folks round here don't feel too kindly disposed towards them, as a rule. I was stationed at a number of forward operating bases. She broke off to cough again. It was painful just to watch her. Jane could only imagine how painful it was to be her, undergoing this torture. He knew that Foster's wheeze was invariably fatal, but the condition could be managed for years, its worst symptoms reduced almost to zero, if you had access to the right drugs and the wherewithal to pay for them. Barbara had neither, which meant she was sentenced to a purgatory of chest pain, restricted breathing, and these brutal coughing fits. The disease would gradually run its course, killing her by degrees, but it might be as much as another 3 or 4 years before it finally polished her off. They were just tent hospitals, she continued. Describing them as crude would be paying them a compliment. Sometimes it would come down to medical techniques like out of earth that was history. You know, sawing off ruined limbs without any anesthetic beyond a shot of bourbon, which we also used as disinfectant. That bad. But we made do, us doctors and nurses. Had to. It was an endless parade of misery, Mr. Cobb. Men, women, kids even, scarcely older than my Alistair, being brought in on stretchers, screaming, riddled with bullet wounds, guts mangled, maybe an arm hanging on by a shred of flesh, some of them pleading to be put out of their misery. She shuddered at the recollection. Alliance put those brown coats through the mincing machine and didn't even think twice about it. That's what we were fighting against, that level of slaughter, that level of callousness. Should have won, deserved to, but I guess it was not to be. Kind of an unpopular opinion to hold, Jane said. Place like this, on a day like this, I ain't heard nothing but abuse against the browncoats all evening. Barbara gave vent to a bitter laugh, which degenerated into yet another fit of coughing. Abuse, she said. That ain't all. There have been rumors. Mom, I think maybe you've said enough already, said Alistair. You don't need to go bothering Mr. Cobb with any of that other stuff. Jane himself didn't much want to be bothered with any of that other stuff either. He was chafing to get going, but the woman was desperately sick. Least he could do was fake interest. Rumors, he said. You tell him, Alistair, Barbara said. You're the one that overheard it. Weren't nothing, Alistair said after a moment's hesitation. Just some guys talking. I was fetching some groceries, you see, and— No, you weren't, Alistair, his mother snorted. Fetching groceries. I know what you were up to. You were picking pockets. Was not, her son protested. Don't think I don't know how you help us make ends meet, boy. I see how you come home sometimes and you've got cash in your hand, which I earned doing odd jobs. For who? For people. Just people. Just because I'm sick doesn't mean I'm blind, Barbara said. You're only telling me that to protect me. That cash is ill-gotten gains. I see it in your face every time, that little furtive look. A mother can tell these things. I don't condone it, but I don't disapprove neither. You're trying to do your best, seeing as I can't make a living out of nursing anymore. Say, said Jane to Alistair, those two guys who attacked you at— He almost said at Taggart's, in the street, he amended. Had you just tried to rob them? Alistair looked sheepish. I knew it, Barbara declared. You weren't mugged at all, Alistair. You were pickpocketing and you got yourself caught. Alistair looked even more sheepish. Well, this ain't relevant anyways, he said, deflecting. Jane wanted to hear about the rumors. This conversation is far from over, young man, his mother said. If you're going to go around committing thievery, at least try not to get hurt doing it. Speaking of which, Mr. Cobb, there's some antiseptic cream over there and some cotton swabs. While I'm up, I may as well set to fixing Alistair's face. Jane brought over the materials, and Alistair submitted to his mother's ministrations, which she halted every so often in order to turn aside and cough.
Jane was keener than ever to leave, but he felt he had to stay at least until Alistair told him what the rumors about Browncoats were. Politeness, again, coupled with a glimmer of curiosity. Could it be the Independents weren't as noble-hearted and clean-handed as some folk, namely Mal and Zoe, liked to paint them? That'd be ammunition for Jane next time those two got on their high horses about the war. What Alistair said, however, was nothing like what Jane had been anticipating. So, this man I was shadowing, with a mind to lift in his wallet, no doubt, Barbara interjected. Shadowing, Alistair continued, still vainly maintaining the pretense that he was as pure as the driven snow. This was about a week ago. He met up with another man in the street, and they talked a while, and I just kind of hung back, biding my time. It wasn't eavesdropping, exactly, but I couldn't help hearing what they were saying. Conversation turned to Alliance Day because it was coming up, and the first man said something about how the Browncoats won't be celebrating, and the second man laughed and said the Browncoats have even less reason to celebrate this year because it seems there's a whole bunch of people on Persephone who think they're nothing better than war criminals and who are going around bringing them to justice, kind of like a vigilante movement or even a lynch mob. That's why you need to be extra careful these days what you say about the war, Mom, and what you did in it. When you're as sick as I am, Barbara said, kinda doesn't matter so much what you say or don't say. Matters to me, said her son. At any rate, those two guys seemed to think it wasn't just talk. Those vigilantes were real. Both of them thought it was pretty funny, too. Browncoats getting attacked for being Browncoats, like it was no more than they deserved. They say anything else? Said Jane. Alistair shrugged. That's as much of it as I recall. Conversation moved on to other things. Might be gossip, Jane opined. Might just be the one guy spinning the other a line of bullcrap. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if there are Persephonians out there who've got a mad on for former Browncoats, said Barbara. In case you haven't noticed, Mr. Cobb, the majority of folks on this planet are misguided souls who think the Alliance winning was a godsend. They're happy to grovel to the victors, and I guess you could say targeting the losers for punishment is a form of groveling. Maybe the ultimate in groveling. Huh. Jane processed what he'd just learned in the manner in which he always processed things, which is to say slowly and tentatively, like someone picking their way barefoot over wet, slippery rocks. There was, he reckoned, the possibility of a connection between Mal's mysterious disappearance and the existence of a group of anti-browncoat vigilantes. Equally, there might easily be another explanation for where Mal had gotten to, and the vigilante rumors were just that. Rumors. Second-hand rumors, indeed, given they were reaching him via someone else, namely Alistair. He shifted his feet. It was way past time he made tracks. Well, been nice meeting you and all, he said, but you should be going, said Barbara. Yeah, I really do have business to attend to. Thank you again, Mr. Cobb, for looking after Alistair and bringing him back. Please, Jane said, call me Jane. I think, Jane, that you may be a good man, Barbara said. I think, deep down, you have compassion. That's a rare thing. I think you may be confusing me with someone else, Jane replied gruffly, but as he left the apartment, there was a quiet and rather sad smile on his lips, nestled amid the rough bristles of his goatee. He clicked his comm link. Zoe? No reply. He clapped the device against his palm, hoping he might joggle it back into life. Then he tried calling Zoe again with the same lack of result. Damn contraptions. What good was technology if it didn't work like it was supposed to? Swiveling around to get his bearings, Jane set off towards the dock where Serenity was birthed. 9. Cold. Cold, cold ground. And hard. Mal's hips, shoulders, knees, and head bounced as tremendous explosions roared, shaking the earth under him. Out in the open, where there was no cover within reach, the falling firebombs burst in successive waves. They gouged out massive pits, sending tons of rock and debris into the air. The pressure of the detonations crushed the air from his chest.
He wanted to run, but his legs would not support him, and there was nowhere to go anyway.
Death fell randomly from the skies, and the flashes of the explosions flickered orange against the overhanging clouds.
Serenity Valley, where the Browncoats lost 16 brigades and 20 air tank squads near as, where the 2,000 warriors Mal was leading got whittled down to 150, where the 57th Overlanders, his platoon, was all but wiped out, where High Command obliged the troops on the ground to surrender when, given air support at the crucial time, they could maybe have won. In the deepest recesses of his brain, Mal knew he was reliving a past moment, but it sure as hell felt real. Vividly, viscerally so, like he was experiencing it for the first time. Instant obliteration lay on all sides. The terror and paralysis he felt was genuine. As falling rocks pelted him, he curled into a fetal position with hands covering the back of his head. Then, in the midst of the hellish bombardment, the flying dirt and the dark smoke, a white chicken appeared out of nowhere. Oblivious to the danger, it strutted up close to his face and, cocking its head to one side, said, "Evening." At that shocking moment, Mal concluded he had to be dreaming. In his experience, no chicken had a voice that deep. But he was sure someone had spoken because now that he was wide awake, heart hammering up under his chin, the sound of it was still ringing in his ears. He couldn't see anything. Everything was so inky black, it made Mal wonder if he had somehow, some way, suddenly been struck blind. He couldn't tell if his eyes were open, nor move his hands to find out one way or another. Then, as his brain stopped tumbling like a juggling ball inside his skull, the scratchiness at his ears and the end of his nose put the lie to that assumption. Well, damn it, there was a bag over his head. From the coarse feel of it, a burlap bag. No mistaking one thing, it smelled like chicken feed. He was lying on his side on a grated or ribbed surface, perhaps a metal deck. Explosions weren't squashing his chest, it was the shifting G-force mashing him down. And the explosions weren't explosions at all, but the sustained din of rocket exhaust. For sure, he was on some kind of ship, maybe even his own boat, lying on the floor with his hands cinched up behind his back and his ankles tied too. That would likely mean I'm in trouble. Last thing he remembered, and that only foggily, was fighting Hunter Covington and his three goons outside Taggart's, and holding his own until Covington zapped him with some kind of knockout gas from his cobra head cane, a dirty trick if ever there was one. Whatever happened to a good old-fashioned whack on the noggin with a gun butt? His Liberty hammer was gone, of course. He couldn't feel its familiar weight on his hip. Confiscated, no doubt. A sensible precaution on his captor's part, not that he could have reached the weapon anyway, with his hands fastened as they were. He tested the bonds, feeling the roughness of rope around his wrists. Whoever had done the tying had done it right. The knots were so tight his fingers were numb. Same went for the ropes around his ankles. Over the sound of the engines, Mal heard the shuffle of boots on the metal deck. "Evening to you, too," he said affably to whoever the heck it was had spoken to him a moment ago, although it most definitely was not poultry. "Could you please remind me what I did to piss someone off so much?" The burlap sack was yanked off his head, and a gust of sour whiskey breath hit him square in the face. He blinked from the floor, staring up into a bright light, in the middle of which was the silhouette of a man's head with a feathery halo of sandy-colored hair. Mal squinted harder, trying to make out the man's features, but the contrast between the head and the bright light was too extreme.
"Evening," the man said again.
"Is it?" Mal said. "Hard to tell the time when you've got a sack over your head. Just saying." The man bent over him. When he moved his face closer, the details of it became clearer. A set of heavy jowls formed the foundation for a block-shaped head. He wasn't Covington, or for that matter, one of Covington's trio of thugs. Mal had never seen him before. But he had seen the interior of this vessel before. It was Serenity's shuttle, the one that had been sent to Gilder's shipwright for repairs and that he, Jane, and Zoe had been planning to pick up after the meet at Taggart's.
Goram, don't this beat all?
"We going somewhere?"
he inquired cheerily, like he was on some kind of excursion into the countryside with maybe a picnic thrown in. In my shuttle? He added. We sure as hell are, the sandy-haired man said, squatting on his haunches, hairy hands dangling between his legs like a baboon. Mal's vision finally adjusted to the light, and he saw that his captor had bloodshot brown eyes. His face was scarred with what looked like knife cuts or blast wounds on the right side from jawline to temple, although his right ear below the patchy straw-like hair was still pretty much intact. He had perhaps half the regularly mandated quantity of teeth, and those he possessed were browned, thin as rice, and only just clinging onto their foundations in his gums. And a well-worn gun belt around his waist held two pistols, and they were as roughened and ugly as his mug. A third gun, Mal's own Liberty hammer, in a lot better condition than the others, protruded from the belt. Nice piece, Mal said, nodding to it. I've got one just the same. Only I appear to have mislaid it. Scarface smirked. I agree. It's a nice gun. Have me a mind to keep it once all this is over. All this? Care to enlighten me about that? You'll find out soon enough. Well, then, I don't suppose you'd mind answering my earlier question. Where are we headed? Not Pelorum by any chance. Ain't so far from here. And I hear it's lovely whatever the season, but especially at this time of year. Sun, sea, gambling, and so many folks looking for a casual hookup, I reckon even someone as deficient in the looks department as you could get laid. Anger flickered like lightning across Scarface's distorted features. We're delivering you to justice, he grated. That sounded ominous. Mal tried to sit up and failed. The man's upper lip curled in amusement as he savored the struggle and defeat. Justice. Mal repeated. Can you be a little more specific? I like justice, big fan, but I hadn't planned on any side trips today. Did you take back the loaner shuttle? And do you know Hunter Covington?
He was right about you. You are stupid, Scarface said.
Covington insulted me? I'm crushed. I thought we were pals.
No, not him. Someone else.
Who?
He'll find out soon enough.
Mal was putting up a confident front, but he was right uneasy. It was now pretty obvious to him that Covington had never planned for him to deliver anything to anybody. That talk of a lump of metallic ore and somebody called Professor Yakima Barnes had been just so much hogwash. Covington had lured Mal out of Taggart's for the sole purpose of shanghaiing him. And like a big dumbass, Mal had fallen for it. Maybe, he said, if you could explain to me what your beef is, I'm sure I could clear things up.
And maybe you could just shut up, traitor, Scarface snapped.
Traitor? Mal wrinkled his forehead. Who's calling me that?
Donovan Phillips, Scarface said, slapping his chest. That's who's calling you a traitor.
Glad to make your acquaintance, Donovan Phillips.
And I ain't alone in holding that opinion of you. Phillips spat. There's a whole passel of us that thinks scum like you are the lowest form of life and should be exterminated.
Call me sensitive, but I'm picking up a distinctly hostile vibe here, Donnie, old pal. I'm reckoning you've got me confused with somebody else. There another Malcolm Reynolds in your address book? This could turn out to be one of those embarrassing mix-ups we all stand around and laugh about it afterwards over a beer or two.
No misunderstanding, said Phillips. We got the right man.
But I ain't no traitor. Never have been. A traitor to who? Or is it to whom? Never could get that one straight.
You're being called to account, and you'll pay for what you've done.
Been to a lot of places, conducted a lot of business, Mal said. Fairly or not, I suppose I riled some of the folks I dealt with. They were expecting more, got less. But as to treason, maybe you could do me the kindness of dabbing a bit more paint on that canvas.
You ain't the first, and you won't be the last to face the music for that particular crime.
Now that's starting to sound a touch serious.
You'd be right in thinking that, and wise not to be so flippant about it.
Mal was still no nearer an understanding of what the Gaoyang Zhang Du Guyang this was all about. What was clear was that there didn't seem to be any room for negotiation with his captor. Donovan Phillips hadn't subtly floated the possibility of ransom, to be paid cash or barter. It was very much like the sentence of death had already been read, and all that was left was the manner of execution. Mal knew better than to show fear, even when helpless, with no cavalry in sight. "Where might this account calling be located?" he said. "Can you at least tell me that? Is it far from Persephone? Am I going to be able to take my shuttle back? As I think I might have mentioned, I'm in the middle of a few important things."
"Shut up.
No, listen. I really think there's been a case of mistaken
I said shut up."
Phillips balanced himself on one hand and punched Mal square in the face with the other. A searing flash of light filled Mal's skull, blinding him as completely as the chicken feed sack so recently had. In a world of hurt, with the taste of blood in his mouth, his head dropped, slamming hard on the metal. Back to the black, the drifting black, tumbling, tumbling, tumbling. Explosions. 10. Zoe gave her comlink one last futile try, then hustled over to Badger's hideout, into which Harlow had disappeared not half a minute earlier. At the door, her way was blocked by a big man whose bloated belly strained against his sleeveless gray t-shirt. Blurred brown tattoos of Chinese characters ran up and down both arms from wrist to shoulder. He held up one hand in front of her face, and the other dropped to the grip of the machine pistol slung over his shoulder, which reminded Zoe that even if Badger was smarmy and low class, he and his minions were still capable of causing a great deal of trouble for them. She said to the guard, "I'm here to see Badger. Tell him it's Zoe Washburn and that it's urgent."
"You want in, give me your weapons," he growled. "All of them."
"First, go tell him I'm here," she said. She knew this was Badger's standard procedure for a private interview, and his excess of caution, which bordered on paranoia, was one of the reasons he was still sucking air. Zoe didn't like the idea of being outgunned when everything seemed to be going to hell, but under the circumstances, she had no choice. She noted to herself that Harlow hadn't been forced to disarm when he'd gone in. She knew he was carrying that six gun inside his duster. The lack of even a pat-down to check for weapons indicated that he was either a friend or a lackey of Badger's. Her money was on lackey. The guard smirked and waved a finger under her nose.
"No, first you give me your weapons."
With a shrug and a certain amount of chagrin, Zoe handed over her mare's leg. Then she unsheathed the 8-inch hunting knife that balanced out her holster rig. The guard gathered the weapons like a haul from under the Christmas tree.
"Borowski,"
he called through the door over his shoulder. The door opened a crack and a second man stuck out his head. His doughy, pale face was blotched with red. To Zoe, it looked like an allergic reaction, maybe mild radiation poisoning.
"Tell Badger that Zoe... Washbasin, is it?"
"Washburn.
Zoe Washburn is here to see him."
"And it's urgent," Zoe reminded him.
"And it's urgent," the guard relayed in a sarcastic drawl.
Borowski nodded and closed the door. Presently, he returned, signaling for Zoe to follow him. They strode through a dingy, poorly lit foyer cluttered by packing crates and metal drums. Borowski pushed open the Moroccan print curtains that passed for office doors. Badger's office was gritty with obnoxious royal blue walls and decorated with rug market odds and ends. The man himself sat in a shabby, overstuffed brown leather office chair behind a desk covered in miscellaneous papers, soiled plates, unidentifiable gizmos, and an overloaded wire mesh in-and-out box. Badger looked her up and down, dark eyes glittering.
"Watcha, Miss Washburn," he said.
"Mrs.," said Zoe crisply.
"Yep, sorry, Mrs. Washburn. It's just, you never seem like a married woman."
"And how should a married woman seem?"
"I dunno, a bit more wifely."
"Well, what a pity I don't live up to that high standard."
Badger shrugged as if in agreement. "Can't help notice you're looking a little lame in the leg there. Tisk, tisk. Hurt ourselves, have we?"
Before she could answer, he picked up an apple and crunched into it appreciatively.
What I find most interesting about you and your mate, he went on, is how predictable you are. Don't tell me, let me guess. Dare I say, bar fight?
Zoe canted her head to the side, the most reluctant of admissions that he was correct.
And you've come to see me, why?
First of all, where's Harlow? She asked, scanning the room.
You got business with him? He asked, very interested. Of what sort, may I ask?
That's none of your concern, she said. He walked in here, but he didn't walk back out. She lifted her chin and raised her voice.
Harlow, if you're in the building—
He's not, Badger said. And shouting isn't gonna bring the bloke back. He left by that door.
He gestured with his head towards the back of the room.
You might be able to catch up with him if you break into a run.
His wry smile told her that he didn't think that was too likely. The two of them regarded each other, a momentary standoff. Badger could be lying about Harlow being gone, Zoe thought, but what did he have to gain from that? A more important question was, since Harlow and Badger seemed to be connected, could Badger be behind Mal's disappearance? Was he the one who had orchestrated the whole scheme? He could have hired Covington to abduct Mal, and Harlow had just now reported back to say, mission accomplished. On its face, that scenario seemed unlikely. Taking Mal out of the equation would impede delivery of the important cargo and possibly stop the transfer of related bags of coin into Badger's coffers. Still, Zoe knew the shabby criminal thought himself capable of playing more than one level of simultaneous chess, despite all evidence to the contrary. Was that what he was doing?
Harlow wasn't here long, Zoe observed, breaking the brief interlude of silence between them. Couldn't have been but 2 minutes since he came in.
I work fast, Badger said. Time is money.
What was he here for?
Well, now, that's interesting. Dunno if it's coincidence or not, but he had some info for me. About a certain woman who was looking for a certain missing friend who may or may not have been nabbed by someone. Unto Covington, no less.
You know Covington?
Can't work an eaves down and not know Unto Covington.
Harlow said he didn't.
Harlow's a daft wanker. Anyway, apparently my name came up in the conversation, and Harlow thought I ought to know. Thought I might slip him a coin or two in return for telling me. You can imagine my views on that.
Less than positive, I'd have said.
Too right, too bloody right. Set him packing with a flea in his ear. Not sure why anyone would reckon I care about being talked about behind my back. I mean, I'm a local celebrity. Goes with the territory. But that's the trouble with geezers like Harlow, bottom-feeding grifters who've somehow got it into their heads they're entrepreneurs. If there's even a chance they can turn a profit from something.
Badger's expression, sly by default, turned slyer still.
Funnily enough, it just so happens the woman he spoke about sounded an awful lot like you, Mrs. Washburn. Balls of brass, he said, with a side order of gorgeous, which leads me to wonder whether I might be well acquainted with your friend was gone missing.
Zoe decided she had no option but to come clean. There was a chance, however remote, that telling Badger the truth might help her. It might at least prompt Badger into initiating a search for Mal because Badger had a dog in this fight. Without Mal, his cargo might not make it to its destination.
I'm looking for Mal Reynolds, she said.
Ho-ho! Badger chortled, clapping his palms together.
He leaned back in his chair, planted his boot heels on his desktop, and laced his fingers behind his neck.
That's it, is it? Captain Malcolm Reynolds has taken a sudden, unexpected leave of absence. What a surprising development.
I take it you didn't have anything to do with it.
I'm shocked, Badger declared, hand on heart. Truly, deeply shocked, and not a little offended. Answer me this, Mrs. Washburn. Why the bleedneck would I kidnap him? Captain who's transporting goods for me. That would run counter to my own immediate interest, wouldn't it? My suggestion is, since it's Alliance Day, you should inquire at the local lockup. Maybe Reynolds got loaded and a bit leery. Wouldn't put it past him. The authorities don't hold much with drunken disorderlies round here. They expect everyone to comport themselves in a genteel fashion like what I do. Mind you, if Reynolds had got himself thrown in the detox tank, he'd surely have used his right to a single wave and contacted you or your ship. Assuming, of course, that the arresting officers had granted him that privilege on what would have to be one of their busiest nights of the year.
Mal wasn't drunk this evening and never got the chance to be disorderly, Zoe said. Something else has happened.
Badger took another big bite of apple and, eyes narrowed, methodically crushed it to mush between his back teeth.
Well, now, ain't this a pretty predicament? Especially with my crates of HTX-20 in your hold.
We're taking care of them.
Time is of the essence, he said. The very essential essence.
He fished an apple seed out of his mouth.
In fact, all things considered, I find it a touch perturbing that you're still planetside.
We'll be leaving shortly, Zoe bit off.
That's good. And I'm sure once Captain Reynolds wakes up from his drunken stupor, he'll give you a wave to tell you everything's hunky-dory.
She maintained her silence.
Tick-tock, tick-tock, Badger sang out. Clock's running.
We can't lift off till Mal's aboard to give the signal, Zoe said resolutely. If that's a problem for you, you can find someone else to transport the goods.
Badger's eyebrows shot up. Surely you wouldn't renege on our deal. I'd hate for a lapse like that to become public knowledge. Remember what happened to Reynolds and your husband when you disappointed Adelaide Niska?
Remember what happened to Adelaide Niska's henchman? Zoe shot back.
Oh, dear lady, I'm no one's henchman, Badger said. I'm the big cheese, the kingpin, a force in the community. If I spread word that you lot can't be trusted...
I'm unloading the crates, she declared. You can find someone else to transport your cargo.
Badger frowned.
It's too late for that. The HTX-20 is already breaking down. It's got a limited shelf life, and we have an agreement, he protested.
Just then, Borowski gestured to his boss. He might have been the forklift operator who'd loaded the crates, Zoe thought, but Badger's men tended to look alike, solidly muscled and unkempt. The man was holding out a comm tablet. Badger said,
Excuse me, missus, one moment.
He hurried over to the man and took the tablet, his lips moving as he scrolled with a fingertip. He said something under his breath to Borowski, and they both looked at her. Badger walked back to her with the tablet, which he waved in the air like a trophy.
Well, seems you got no choice but to keep my goods in your hold and get the ruddy hell out of here.
He tapped the tablet with his finger.
This is a bulletin just got sent out all across the cortex. Feds are hot on your tail. Seems you people have something they want. What is that, I wonder?
What you got on board they're so flaming interested in? Zoe scanned the bulletin, suppressing a sigh of exasperation.
What are the Alliance so interested in? Only River and Simon Tam has to be.
The Alliance was desperate to get its hands on the Tams, especially River, whom it seemed to consider its property. That detail was absent from the wave, and just as well, or Badger would even now be trying to detain Zoe rather than urging her to leave, so that he could garner a portion of the bounty on the Tams' heads. If, however, another bulletin came through that mentioned the Tams explicitly, or even worse, if the Alliance caught up to Serenity, the siblings would be bound by law and River would be sent back to the place that her big brother had sacrificed everything to get her out of.
Chingwat Saldaliamung,
Zoe thought. Badger was right. Mal or no Mal, she had to get Serenity off this world, ASAP.
Well? Badger prompted. Can't say, Zoe replied. Could be any number of reasons. You know us. We sail close to the wind.
Not too close, I hope, for my sake.
Don't worry. We're going to finish the job, she told him.
He grinned at her.
You mean you'll skedaddle?
She gave Badger a hard look.
And let me get something straight. If you are entertaining any notions of double-crossing us, sending the Alliance our way...
Whoa. Badger held up his hands. I'm crushed you think so little of me. I don't peach on my partners. I've got a reputation to protect. I've got roots in the alternative income community. I live here.
Still, if Alliance troops come and I find out you sent them, she persisted... You won't be living anywhere.
He chuckled. Such loyalty to your captain. What you see in that cranky old sergeant that makes you do or die for him? It can't be that he pays you well. As near as I can tell, he hardly ever pays you.
I don't think you'd understand, even if I had the time to explain it to you, Zoe said. But please, if you do get any information about Mal.
No worries there, darling. I'll let you know, of course. And for a fair market price.
Disgusted, Zoe spun on her heel and left his den. Overhead, as she recovered her weapons from the tattooed sentry, the bunting and pennants of Alliance Day flapped as if waving her on.
Hurry. Hurry.
Limping away down the street, she contacted Serenity.
Did you find him?
Wash asked her first thing.
No, I didn't find him, Zoe said in a rush. Now listen up, lover. According to Badger, the Alliance is closing in on us.
When are they ever not?
But I saw a bulletin, and this time it sounds like they mean business. I need a ride back to the ship, pronto. I'm moving slowly.
My desert flower, are you hurt?
Just a bit banged up.
It bugged her to confess it.
I'm on my way in the mule to get you myself, he said.
No, you need to be ready to lift off in case the Alliance shows up.
Zoe, is Book back?
Just got in. Send him to fetch me.
If we get in a scrape at this end, he'll be able to help.
More than once, Alliance military personnel had shown deference to Shepherd Book. No one aboard the ship knew why, and Book hadn't seen fit to elaborate, but she knew he would be her best bet.
What if the feds board us before you took it back?
Wash said.
The Preacher might do more good here. We can't risk Kaylee either. Someone's got to hold Serenity's engine together during the pre-flight warm-up. Inara's free. Well, not free, but you know what I mean.
She's not regular crew,
but she is a registered companion. She did great on Higgins' moon. People always bow and scrape and do whatever she wants.
I'm here, Inara said through the comlink. Of course I'll come, Zoe.
Thank you, Inara.
I'll find Jane if I can, and we'll meet you by the store where the captain bought Kaylee her dress.
All right, Inara said.
Wash, after Inara leaves, you see them Alliance bastards coming for the ship. Don't wait for control tower clearance. Forget the Goram blast zone safety wrecks. You light her up, hear me?
Roger, baby, Wash said. We'll be out of here like a cat with a firework tied to its tail. Not that I'd know what that's like, because I never tied a firework to a cat's tail as a kid. And anyone who says I did is a liar.
11. For several minutes, Wash fidgeted with his collection of model dinosaurs, too distracted to stage exciting claw and fang fights. It was hard to keep a lid on his freakout. Once upon a time, at Li Shen's space bazaar, he had cracked open a fortune cookie that read, "You will live in interesting times." Enough with the interesting, bring on the boredom.
"They back yet?"
Kaylee asked, poking her head through the hatchway. She was wearing overalls decorated with happy teddy bear patches and a pink t-shirt splotched with engine grease.
"No," Wash told her, depositing a T-Rex into the pocket of his vintage Hawaiian shirt for safekeeping.
"No fun. What's this I'm hearing about the Alliance maybe boarding us? Inara mentioned it as she was getting into the flying mule just now. She said there wasn't time to explain and I should ask you."
Wash pulled up the latest Cortex-wide Alliance bulletin on screen, which was undoubtedly the one Zoe had been referring to. It advised security personnel to be on the lookout for a Firefly-class transport suspected of an illegal smuggling operation.
"Has to be us," he said.
"And has to be about River," said Kaylee. "How come it doesn't mention her by name, though? Or Simon?"
"Mal has a theory about Alliance bureaucracy. He reckons different departments create bulletins like this and fling them out at random like a drunk guy playing darts. One in the bullseye, one in the back of Joe Bob's head. Some of the agencies know about the existence of the TAMs and some don't, and they don't always talk to each other. At least, not in the same language. Not that I much care. To a snail, a duck is a vengeful god."
"What? It's a saying."
"A saying said by who?"
"By, me?" said Wash. "More and more, though, this situation with River and Simon has given me the heebie-jeebies. It's like we're playing roulette every day, and every day there's another zero on the wheel. There are times when you have to ask yourself if we mightn't be better off ditching River."
"Oh, hey, sweetie,"
Kaylee said, pointedly cutting Wash off. Wash looked over to see River standing on the threshold of the bridge. Her eyes were enormous and streaked with tears. She was shivering as if she were freezing. Simon rushed up behind her, his gaze connecting with Wash's. "Let's get you to your bunk, River," Simon said, his cheeks reddening with embarrassment or consternation, or some of both. River held out her hands and started waving them around as if brushing away spider webs. "They're coming. They're coming." Wash recoiled at the sight of the waving hands. "Ode Tiana, talk about the heebie-jeebies." The crew had already had a run-in with two men wearing powder blue gloves who were after River. Alliance officers who had gotten in the gloved men's way had wound up dead, blood gushing from all their orifices. "River, do you think they're after us?" he asked carefully. "The men with the hands of blue." River seemed to have a way of sensing things. Or maybe it was simply that because she rambled all over the place on occasion, she made sense. It was so hard to tell. She looked at Wash, then saluted. "Avast ye, matey. Hit the turbos and set sail for the horizon." "Yeah, sure. I'll do that," he buzzed Zoe. "Honey?" "I haven't located Jane," Zoe reported. "But wait a moment. That's Inara in the mule. She's just spotted me." "Is something wrong, Wash?" "River's singing about the blue hands," he said. By way of replying, Zoe let loose a long and complicated curse. Wash said, "Please hurry." 12. Inara hard-banked the bulldozer yellow MF-813 mule to avoid a mob of Alliance Day revelers who had staggered into the middle of the street. Dressed in a shimmering gown and her jeweled golden snood, she allowed everyone to see that a companion moved among them. An armed companion. In the folds of her gown, a gray buckskin shoulder holster cradled her Ruger Mark II 22 caliber pistol with flash suppressor. The hovercraft had no windscreen or overhead canopy for the pilot, just low tubular railings along the sides. Although it could carry four passengers, two seated, two standing, its primary function was cargo transport. The street was packed with Alliance Day partygoers on their annual celebratory whoop-de-doop. With no way to avoid them, Inara advanced the hovercraft at a crawl. The crowd cheered and bowed, drunk, yet impressed. Rug and jewelry stands lined both sides of the avenue. Hookah bars, outdoor grills, noodle shops spewed forth a riot of smoky and spicy aromas. At the designated rendezvous point, she spied Zoe, who stepped out from the shadows, pushed through the crowd, and approached the mule as it decelerated and touched down. To Inara, she looked tired and frazzled. She grimaced in pain as she climbed on board and then dropped heavily into one of the passenger seats. "Are you badly hurt?" Inara asked with concern. "I'm fine," Zoe said. "Where's Jane?" "Don't know. We split up." "Hey!" a deep voice bellowed from close by. The sound of heavy footfalls followed. On instinct, Zoe reached for her mare's leg, relaxing as she saw Jane jogging over towards the mule. "Good thing I ran into you guys," he said. "I was getting tired of walking." He clambered aboard. There was no room to turn the mule around, what with all the pedestrians and the shopping stalls spilling over the curbs. Reversing course was out of the question because of the traffic that had backed up behind them. Inara steered the mule forward and at the first available side street turned right, wending her way back to the docks by a circuitous route. As they floated above the potholed roadway, Zoe's face took on a placid, mask-like expression. Outwardly, she looked completely calm, but attuned to people's moods as Inara was from her years of companion training, she knew that Zoe often affected this expression when the Guoxi was flying in the direction of the fan and the ship and crew were in real trouble. She bit back her questions about what had happened and where Mal was. She herself knew a thing or two about self-control and about patience. At the docks, Inara drove across the airfield along designated pathways fringed by painted hazard stripes. On all sides, lit by Kleegs on widely spaced stanchions, rows of parked spacecraft sat. Clusters of transporters loaded and offloaded their cargoes. Here and there was a crater in the ground where a vessel had crashed. The mule passed a line of passengers in shiny silk print robes with belongings in hand and balanced on top of their heads, queuing for an incoming passenger liner. The docks never slept. When they reached Serenity, Inara drove up the illuminated gangplank and into the hold. She parked gingerly, but with precision, beside the crates of HTX-20. Simon and Shepherd Book came down the stairway as she killed the engine. Jane vaulted out of the mule. With difficulty, Zoe climbed to the deck and took a hesitant, limping step. She stiffened and froze in obvious pain. Simon hurried over to her and, bending down on one knee, examined her ankle and shin. Zoe said, pulling away from his touch. "We have to get you to the infirmary. See what's going on with your leg," Simon told her, straightening up and looking her in the eye. "Shepherd, we'll need the gurney, and I can walk there," Zoe insisted. To Book, she said, "Any news on the captain?" Shepherd Book shook his head. "Not yet, I'm afraid. But since there's no alliance in sight, perhaps we can afford to wait a few more minutes to see if he might arrive before Wash lifts us off." "We don't have much more than that," Zoe said, "and I don't think he'll be arriving at all." Briefly, she outlined her theory that Mal had been abducted. She mentioned the stolen shuttle and expressed her hope that Mal was aboard it, if not of his own volition. "Who?" Inara said, her throat felt tight. "Who would do that?"
"Number of enemies Mal's made in his life? Take your pick," said Jane. "Could be he ain't just been kidnapped. He's dead already."
"What?" Dagger looks were coming at him from all directions. "I'm only saying what we're all thinking."
"None of us is thinking that, Jane," said Inara.
"None of you's trying to, is what you mean," Jane said.
"I hate to say it," said Zoe, "but we're going to have to take off without him."
"No,"
Inara cried. "You know it's the only way, Inara. We've got a time-sensitive cargo, and we've got the feds snapping at our heels. The captain would be the first to agree with me. We can't afford to hang around. It'll be all of our necks if we do."
"Yeah," said Jane. "As a wise man once said, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few."
"That kind of logic doesn't apply here," Inara retorted. "It's Mal we're talking about. Our captain, our friend, our—"
She tried to think of a word to encapsulate how she personally felt about him. She didn't know if there was one. What was going on between her and Mal was too complicated for a single descriptor. It was a tangled knot of inhibitions and unspoken emotions, which they themselves might never get around to unraveling.
"I know," said Zoe.
"I've followed that man into hell more'n once, and I'd follow him again, he just gave the word. But this time hell's following us, and he wouldn't want us to get burned any more than we want to."
Inara recoiled at the idea of leaving Mal behind, and moreover, of quitting the planet without even knowing where he'd gotten to. It wasn't the first time she'd feared that she'd seen the last of him. Mal had come through every scrape, landing on his feet like a cat. But even cats eventually ran out of lives. Zoe limped over to the shipwide intercom and clicked it on. Only Wash and Kaylee weren't with her in the cargo bay, but she made the announcement as if addressing everyone.
"This is Zoe. I'm the acting captain. Captain Reynolds is not here, and the Alliance is bearing down on us. We have cargo aboard that can't wait, so we're taking off in 2 minutes."
Her shoulders slumped. Saying what she'd just said must have taken every ounce of her energy. Inara offered Zoe an arm to help her up the short flight of stairs to the infirmary, but the acting captain, for all that she moved stiffly and in obvious pain, appeared determined to make the climb under her own steam. Leaving Zoe in Simon's care, Inara headed for the bridge, accompanied by Book.
"We are 100% hot and ready to trot," Wash said from the command chair, his hands on the yoke. "Time to go."
He tapped buttons and Serenity's engines roared, straining. The vessel shuddered as it broke gravity.
"Way, look out, Hundan,"
Wash shouted at the ass end of the deep space liner slowly descending above them. The other craft's landing lights blazed in their faces, flooding the flight deck. Violent vibration from combined conflicting gale force rocket exhausts rippled through the superstructure, and the buffeting sent Wash's dinosaurs flying off the console.
"Tamade!"
he yelped, putting the ship into a sickening lurch and barely avoiding a mid-air collision. The buffeting immediately ceased, and Serenity continued to climb.
"Piece of cake," Wash said, staring down at his shaking hands in disbelief.
Inara watched the windshield as the curvature of Persephone shrank from view and they lifted into the black. The preacher found her hand and held it. "The captain is a very resourceful man," Book said. She nodded. "And we're resourceful, too," the shepherd continued. "We'll find him. We just need to get organized. Let's all powwow with Zoe in the infirmary and discuss our next move."
"I should stay here in case there's a need for evasive action," Wash said. "Autopilot won't cut it. Our alarm system will alert us to any vessel in our proximity, but this is the Alliance we're talking about. No do-overs."
"Agreed," Book said. Wash got on the horn.
"All crew who aren't me, please convene in the infirmary," he said. "In the infirmary now, please."
Inara and the preacher left the flight deck and met up with Kaylee, who was just leaving the engine room. She was not looking best pleased.
"We took off without Mal?" she said glumly. "We had to, Maymay," Inara gentled her. "There's a bulletin out for Simon and River, and Badger told Zoe that the Alliance is coming after us. We can't stay."
"But where is he? Inara, he could be in trouble. I mean, he is in trouble. If he wasn't, he'd have let us know by now what's going on. He'd have found some way to."
Inara nodded. "What I'm hoping is we've misconstrued the situation, and Mal has gone after whoever it was who stole the shuttle. That's why he's incommunicado. He can't break radio silence for fear of giving himself away." Kaylee shook her head.
"This is bad. Really, really bad. We don't leave our folk behind. That's not us."
"We'll find him, Kaylee."
Inara wiped a blotch of engine oil off the end of the engineer's nose with a fingertip.
"It's going to be all right. I promise."
Kaylee saw the oil on Inara's finger. She took out a handkerchief and started rubbing at her face.
"He's just reckless sometimes. No, not reckless. More like daring."
"Reckless is the better word," Inara thought.
She put her arm around Kaylee's shoulders and they headed for the infirmary. Zoe sat on the examination table with one boot off and her pants leg rolled up. Spread across her shin was a bulbous fresh bruise, roughly crescent-shaped and purple as a plum. Kaylee made a face.
"No wonder you're limping," she said.
She looked at Simon.
"Is her leg broke?"
"Hairline fracture of the tibia," he said to Zoe. "It's minor, even though it might not feel that way. But you need to ice the affected area and stay off the leg for a couple of days."
Kaylee visibly drooped. Zoe ticked her gaze at the engineer and said,
"It's nothing to worry about, Kaylee. I can still do what needs doing."
Kaylee nodded and managed a weak smile. She said,
"I know."
But she didn't look reassured. She was twisting her fingers together.
"We're going to look for him as soon as we can, right?"
"We need to have a plan," Shepherd Book said. He inclined his head in Zoe's direction. "If you're up to it."
"She's got to be up to it,"
Kaylee frowned.
"You are up to it, right, Zoe?"
Zoe nodded, wincing as Simon applied ointment to her scratches.
"First, I'll tell you everything I know."
Inara listened intently as Zoe described in full the events of the evening, including the bar fight, her encounter with Harlow, and her trip to Badger's. While she was doing so, Jane appeared in the doorway and listened in.
"Don't know what any of this stuff about betrayal and an overdue price Covington said might mean," she said, "but it's got to mean something. Same goes for the graffiti on the gate of the place where he handed Mal over to the kidnappers."
"Yeah, about that," said Jane. "I've got wind of an interest in—"
"And you're quite sure that Badger isn't involved with the captain's disappearance?" Book said. He either hadn't heard Jane or felt that the big man didn't have anything of value to contribute to the discussion. The latter was more likely, since it was usually the case.
"It wouldn't surprise me if he is."
"I doubt it," said Zoe. "Badger wants his cargo delivered, so why would he hold us up?"
"As I was saying, I heard something might be relevant," Jane tried again.
"Seems there's—" "What if it's been Alliance all along?" Simon suggested. "What if Mal's disappearance and the Alliance bulletin are part and parcel of the same thing? This Hunter Covington fellow could be an Alliance informant, perhaps, or a stooge. Right now, Mal could be a prisoner in a cell aboard a Tohoku-class cruiser being pumped for information."
"Not a nice thought," said Kaylee. "Why would you say such a thing, Simon?"
He shrugged. "We're brainstorming.
The idea just occurred to me. I felt it needed to be said. I'm sorry.
You should be, Kaylee scolded.
Vigilantes, Jane thundered.
Everyone turned and looked at him.
What?
Said Zoe.
Now you're all listening to me, Jane said. I was wondering what a man had to do to get his voice heard around here.
Vigilantes, said Book.
The kid, Jane said. The one Zoe and I rescued at Taggart's. Alistair. He and his mom told me there's this group of vigilantes on Persephone who've taken a strong dislike to browncoats.
And you're telling us this only now? Said Zoe.
I've been trying to get a word in edgeways. Besides, it ain't a dead cert. Could be it's got nothing to do with any of this whatsoever. But still, Alistair overheard some guy claiming there's folks eager to take revenge on browncoats for all the wrong they'd done during the war.
Browncoats did not do wrong, Kaylee cut in. Did they, Zoe?
What was the name of the group? Zoe asked Jane. Did he say?
No.
Vigilantes, Book said, targeting browncoats. You know, it wouldn't be the first time I've heard tell of such a thing.
Care to elaborate, Shepard? Inara said.
After the war, Book said, there were a number of extremist independent factions who felt that certain aspects of the peace were inadequate. Their thinking was that members of the browncoat leadership had surrendered too easily and conceded too much to the Alliance, and that these people were, in effect, wrongdoers who had escaped punishment. Secret societies formed in order to mete out justice.
Is this true? Said Kaylee.
Even in the cloistered confines of Southdown Abbey, rumors to that effect reached us, Book replied. The vigilantes were known to sneak into houses at night and kidnap people out of their beds while they slept. Their victims were never seen again. Anyone who got in their way was taken care of, too. Seems a gang of such ruthless individuals might well be operating on Persephone.
So if someone is saying Mal is a traitor, Zoe said, it isn't too much of a stretch to assume vigilantes, the kind you're talking about, the sour grapes about the war kind, have taken him.
Oh no, Kaylee cried. What would they want with the captain? He never did nothing wrong.
Maybe he did, and you just don't know it, Jane said with a fierce grin.
The room went quiet again. Everyone stared at Jane in disbelief. Even though they knew his loyalty was always in doubt, to accuse the captain of betraying the browncoat seemed a step too far. As mysterious as Mal was, as protective of his past, Inara knew that he had given his all in the fight for independence, and that he would do it over again even if he knew the result would be the same. Jane was unrepentant and defiant in the face of unified opposition.
Just saying. People done all kinds of things in the war they ain't proud of.
No, Kaylee said. I know the captain. I mean, I don't know everything about him, but I know that isn't him.
But you don't, Jane argued. You just know what you want to know.
Mal laid his life on the line more than 100 times during the fighting, Zoe said, her teeth clenching as she struggled to maintain her composure. I saw it with my own 2 eyes. I was there.
Maybe you saw what he let you see, Jane said smugly.
He thought he was on a roll.
Jane, you don't want to be here right now, Zoe said, beginning to rise. Zoe, please hold still, Simon said. You're going to waste my doctoring efforts.
Kaylee said, what?